It's Here and Now. I'm Lisa Mullins. President Trump acknowledged with a tweet today that employees at the Commerce and Justice Departments are hard at work on this July 4th holiday. They're scrambling to find a legal justification to add a question to the census that asks whether someone is an American citizen. The rush began yesterday when Donald Trump declared on Twitter that he wanted the question added to the survey. That was one day after the census form started to be printed without the question because the Supreme Court ruled it out for now. Yesterday, two federal judges ordered the administration to justify its reasoning for the move. Let's get the latest now from Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, how unusual is this?
I can't overstate how unusual what happened in court was yesterday, where lawyers of the Justice Department reversed their own representation from the day before, said that other than President Trump's tweet, they had no guidance about what was happening, and that they had been instructed kind of from above to come up or to see if they could come up with a legal rationale for adding the citizenship question. What makes this so unusual is there's just no question that the day before, when they were saying that the administration was ready to drop the citizenship question, or at least that forms were being printed without it, it is clear that the Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr, and the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, had signed off on this decision. So this really did come from President Trump, and it's a reversal of the administration's own position in response to the Supreme Court's decision.
And here's what the president said Monday about the Supreme Court's decision to have the question cut for now.
So you can ask other things, but you can't ask whether or not somebody's a citizen. So we are trying to do that. We're looking at that very soon.
Why did the Supreme Court leave a window open on the question?
The key opinion, the majority opinion, is from Chief Justice John Roberts, and he said that the government had the authority to add this question, but had to provide a plausible, true rationale for doing so. And Robert said that the rationale that the Commerce Department had so far supplied was contrived. In other words, it was made up. It was a pretext. And so the idea was, well, if you can go back, Commerce Department, and come up with a reason that is your real reason for doing this, then we'll look at that and consider whether to let the citizenship question appear on the census forms in the end.
So today there are reports that the president might issue an executive order to make it happen. Is that all it would take?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the problems with the Commerce Department's lack of a plausible rationale would presumably also apply to the executive order. In other words, Trump just can't do an end run around the process that has already gone through the courts by, you know, signing a piece of paper with his pen. It has the same burden as the Commerce Department has. And so I think that would just be a kind of another loop in the litigation of trying to look at the rationale behind the decision and whether it is in fact plausible. Not a high bar, right?
Well, could you clarify, though, what kind of argument the administration might make in the courts? Because yesterday, two federal judges who had ruled against the question set deadlines for the White House to respond. A judge in Maryland wants the answer by tomorrow afternoon. A judge in New York wants answers by next week. What could the administration say?
Right. That's a great question. The administration could say, hey, we're just gathering information for the sake of doing that. It could continue to try to make this original justification, we're trying to enforce the Voting Rights Act. It could try to provide evidence that that was, in fact, the justification. I think that would be very difficult based on the court record. Justice Alito, in a concurrence last week, said that one rationale would be to help the United States government protect immigrants against discrimination. The Trump administration could try to claim that that's its true rationale. I'm not sure what evidence that would be there would be for that. And then the one other option is to allow districts, electoral districts for state and local elections, to be drawn on the basis of citizenship, as opposed to the one person, one vote, full population count we currently use. It's possible that's a legal route. It hasn't been tested before. It is probably what was really going on in the first place, based on the record. And the Trump administration has so far not said that, not tried to justify that. It would be a huge shift in political power if we did redistricting based merely on the count of citizens. It's a shift that would benefit mostly white and Republican rural voters.
Could this go back to the Supreme Court?
Yes, absolutely. I think if the Trump administration really pursues this route of looking for an alternate justification and continues to try to add the citizenship question, it will absolutely go back to the Supreme Court.
And the reaction to all of this outside of the Justice Department in wider circles is what? I mean, Trump has his defenders and his critics.
I think there's just deep concern about the census. The census is a huge mission. It's our biggest peacetime mission that we conduct. It's complicated. There are all these moving parts. When you start making it shaky because you're delaying or you're not clear about the process you're going to use, you threaten the accuracy of the count. And so I think there's real concern about census observers and immigrants' rights groups that the Census Bureau will be forced to cut corners, to do things in a rush in a way that will only undermine the accuracy of the census. And there's also just the problem of the damage that's already been done with all the publicity about the citizenship question. People who are afraid to give information to the government because they're not citizens or they live with people who aren't citizens, they may still be afraid no matter what reassurances are provided at this point.
Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Every year, thousands of people become naturalized U.S. citizens. Since 2005, 3,200 students have gone through the preparation program offered to immigrants through Montgomery College in Maryland have become citizens. Nancy Newton is the program director. And Nancy, what distinguishes your program from others?
We are quite unusual in that we ask our students to look beyond taking the test and the oath. To become a citizen, you have to know history and government and also English language. But we also want our students to look at what it means to become a member of the community in the U.S.
And how do you do that? I know you, for one thing, you ask them to volunteer. And I wonder about that because you would think that a lot of these newcomers, assuming most are newcomers, are just trying to get up to speed with the culture and with making a living.
Right. And that's a little bit of a misconception about naturalization because it is quite a long process. People may have been in the United States for a number of years. So we actually find that quite a lot of our students are already volunteering. And then we just ask to continue and then to take their family members along. Something as simple as going to the library and getting a library card, because for a lot of our learners, a library in their native country is like a museum. They're not sure of all the services that are availed at the library. So getting a library card can open them up to, and their children up to, such a great world of possibilities.
Can you think of one particular story that you would consider a success that has to do with one of your students who has gone out into the community?
Yes. So we have a student who was a high beginning level English learner. So her English language was somewhat limited. So she hired herself a taxi for the day and she went around to all the monuments in DC. And she wanted to really immerse herself in history of the United States, the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Memorial. And along the way, she reported back that she felt so enamored by what she felt. And afterwards, she went home and she began to volunteer at a local church. And from there, she got her friends involved in volunteering, all from, you know, just going out, jumping in a taxi and talking to people at the National Monument.
Where was she from, by the way?
She's from Iraq.
I mean, that sounds like the kind of result that you want.
It really is, Lisa, because naturalization is the culmination of such a long journey for a lot of, you know, our learners. And so when they come in and they say, oh, you know, I've done this and now I'm involved with volunteering and I'm really starting to understand, you know, the United States, it's a feeling you don't often get in your everyday job.
And you went through the process yourself. You're from England. You became a naturalized citizen. I would imagine that your experience was quite different from those of your students right now. Compare the two for us.
Yes, quite different. I originally came over to the US as an au pair, so I was Mary Poppins. But for me, I'm a native English speaker. I'm white. And it was rather simple. But for some of our learners, it's been so harrowing. Some of them with very limited English. And having to navigate a system when English is not your first language is extraordinarily difficult. So it's requires a lot of support for our learners. But then once you get through the process and you've been fingerprinted and your background check has been done and you go to the actual interview for naturalization and suddenly you're looking at somebody and they're saying, so who was the first president of the United States? And your mind goes blank. I like chicken. You know, you don't have, you know, the circumstances aren't great. So that's why in our program, we try and help people to remember to breathe. You must remember to breathe when you go there. But the feeling that you get after an officer says to you, congratulations, you've passed, is second to none. Because for a lot of our learners, that means now the beginning of a new journey.
Nancy Newton is the Citizenship Program Director at Montgomery College. Nancy, nice to talk to you. Thank you and happy 4th of July.
Thank you. You too, Lisa. Have a lovely day.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
We've got a big weekend coming up in the world of sports. The Tour de France bicycle extravaganza starts Saturday, and the Women's World Cup final is Sunday. The U.S. women will play the Netherlands for the title on Sunday in France. Meanwhile, basketball fans are keeping tabs on free agency. Let's bring in Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst and host of the daily podcast The Gist from Slate.com. Mike, why don't we start off with two of the biggest NBA stars who are switching teams. Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving are heading off to play for the Brooklyn Nets. Question is, why Brooklyn?
Brooklyn is a cool place to live. I live 2 blocks from there. That, by the way, is something. The Nets are a very well-run team. They haven't had huge success, but they've been on the upswing. Their management, their coach, Kenny Atkinson, attractive place to play. But really what it is the players themselves, it's called the player empowerment era. They get together, they work out a destination where they'd be happy. And essentially, you know, DeAndre Jordan, who's another player going to Brooklyn, gets together with his friends Kyrie and Kevin Durant, and they all decide to go. Now, we should say Durant's probably going to be out all of next year because he had a grievous injury in the playoffs. But it's a 4-year contract, so the future looks bright on Flatbush Avenue.
Durant is leaving the Golden State Warriors, who lost to the Toronto Raptors in the NBA Finals this season. But the Warriors have been the gold standard, so to speak, in the NBA for the past few years. But do you think that is done?
Yeah, I think it's done. I wouldn't say that they are for certain going to be a losing team, but not only do they lose Durant, but they also lose Klay Thompson, who also, like Durant, had a terrible injury in the finals. They also lose a key component, a great defensive player, Andre Iguodala. I mean, I just looked at the Las Vegas odds. In past years, not only were they a favorite, they were what's called the odds-on favorite. You'd have to bet, you know, $150 to win $100 if they won the NBA title. They're probably going to go off as like more of a 20-to-1 shot this year.
So that still leaves the biggest name out there, Kawhi Leonard, who led the Raptors to the NBA championship. Could Toronto afford to let him go?
They might not have a choice. I said player empowerment era before. That's what it is. This wouldn't be Kawhi stabbing them in the back or anything like that. He did deliver a championship unto the North. But this was essentially, they knew it was a 1-year rental when they made the trade for Kawhi from the Spurs. And if Kawhi decides that his passions lie there north of the border, he could re-up. But there just seems to be a lot of indication that he's interested in one of the Southern California teams, the LA Clippers, the LA Lakers.
Yeah, I mean, you think they would want to be with a winning team, which now the Toronto Raptors are. But I guess we have to keep in mind that they are players and they are businessmen.
Well, the other thing is, when you have players this good, they are a winning team. You know, Kawhi Leonard can go to any team in the league, and I do mean this. He could go to the worst team in the league, which was the Knicks last year. Kawhi Leonard alone, there are 3 or 4 guys. That player alone makes the team a winning team, such as the nature of basketball and the excellence of the individual players we're talking about.
So what's happening with LeBron James and the Lakers? They didn't even make it to the playoffs this past season. Is James attracting other star players to join him in L.A.?
Yes, one of the other, I don't know, 5 to 10 best players in the league. Anthony Davis is headed to L.A. So that alone makes them one of the favorites to win the NBA title after not even making the playoffs. To get Davis, they traded almost the whole team. But if Kawhi Leonard goes to join them, you have another situation further down the coast of a super team, of a supposedly unbeatable super team. Remember, the last supposedly unbeatable super team was beaten by Kawhi Leonard and his Raptors.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
This week, Syria accused Israel of attacks that killed several people outside the capital, Damascus, as well as near its border with Lebanon. It's been 8 years since a civil war broke out in Syria, and violence has become the norm for locals. According to the United Nations, almost 6 million Syrians have been displaced from their country, and each one of them has a story. WBUR's Yasmin Amer tells us about one man's journey.
37-year-old Hassan Al-Kuntar is from a Syrian city called Sweida. He grew up with two siblings in a tight-knit middle-class family. But it's been more than a decade since Hassan has seen them, and he often reminisces on their fond memories together.
I used to go to farm with my father every weekend, a small farm with some olive trees and small house with no electricity. But there would he teach me the value of the nature, how to not to forget my roots.
In 2006, Hassan traveled to a wealthier state, the United Arab Emirates, or UAE, hoping to give his family greater financial security. But in 2011, everything changed.
The assault began at first light, the Syrian regime bringing war to a city of 700,000.
A brutal civil war broke out in Syria. Hassan knew if he went back home, he'd be forced to serve in the army.
It was against my principles, my morals. I want to build, not to destroy and kill.
Hassan's father died in 2016. He couldn't attend his funeral. And he says what really ate at him is that he wished for the opportunity to make his father truly proud. When Hassan was eventually expelled from the UAE, he went to Malaysia under a temporary visa. When that ran out, he booked a ticket to Ecuador, where travelers can usually get a visa upon entry. As Hassan was waiting to board, the airline staff abruptly canceled his ticket without an explanation or a refund. So there he was, stuck at the Kuala Lumpur airport in Malaysia, unable to leave the terminal, with no money nor visa to go anywhere else. Desperate, he took out his phone and started recording himself and posting on Twitter.
I have been here for the last 5 days now. I'm stuck in here at the transit zone, and there's no other places or countries accepting us. I don't know what should I do.
His videos caught the attention of someone very far away.
By the time we heard about Hassan, he'd been in the airport for about 35 days.
Lori Cooper is a 58-year-old mother of two adult children from Whistler, British Columbia. She teams up with other volunteers to privately sponsor Syrian refugees to come to Canada.
In Hassan's situation, I kind of thought, well, his mom can't help him, but I'm in a position where I might be able to help him. So my personal motivation really comes from, I think, that feeling of being a mom.
Lori sent applications and letters on Hassan's behalf. She collected tens of thousands of signatures for a petition to Canada's immigration minister.
Today is my 90 days. I entered here in March 7. Today is June 6. But I just...
Days turned into months, and Hassan was still at the airport. He was sleeping under a stairwell, eating leftover airline food.
There's no place to shower. There's no place to sleep. I am even sick, but there's no medicine. And this sound, I swear to, I hate this sound. It's everywhere, day and night.
Despite all he was going through, Hassan kept a lot of his social media posts light, making jokes and celebrating the little things.
I just got the chocolate. Yep.
You will start enjoying the little things in your life more. You will start appreciating it more. That was what I was trying to do by... doing the normal stuff to refuse the reality and to keep remind myself and the other world, the outside world, that I'm still a human who deserves to be treated as a human, who should live a normal life.
But he was often reminded of just how far from normal this living nightmare was. Like on his 174th day, when his younger brother got married and he couldn't be at the wedding. Hassan's most difficult days, though, came 7 months after he arrived at the airport. He was arrested by 13 armed guards, taken to a small cold cell, and threatened with deportation to Syria. Lori was traveling when she heard the news.
If he had been deported to Syria, he certainly would have been imprisoned, and it's highly likely that he would have been killed. So I really felt that, you know, he was in a life or death situation, and I thought, what the heck? I never thought in my life that I would be fighting for the life of some person I've never even met.
Hassan was in the dark. The guards wouldn't let him talk to anyone. Still, he believed Lori was still fighting for him.
I had the peace of mind that it's going to be okay at the end.
That day finally came, about 2 months later, when Lori got an alert from Canadian officials. Hassan's sponsorship papers had finally been approved.
Basically, 24 hours notice that he was coming to Canada, and that was just unbelievable.
I knew that it's going to happen one day, but I did not even it would be that much beautiful.
And truly, when I saw him at the airport, it really just felt like my son was coming home. My son was home now.
Hassan has been living with Lori and her family since November, as he adjusts to his new life in Canada. He still can't go home. It's too dangerous. But he's on a mission to try to help other Syrians like him, tell their stories and help them find refuge, something his father would have wanted him to do.
Somehow now I have the peace. He's happy.
Hassan imagines what his father would say to him now, after everything he's been through.
I'm proud of you. That's what he is going to tell me. Proud of you. Keep an eye on the family. Don't forget your people.
That story is produced by Yasmin Ammer of WBUR's Kind World podcast. The U.S. economy entered its 121st month of consecutive growth this week. That's a historic high that beats out the dot-com boom in the 90s by a month. But while all that growth has led to low unemployment, it has increased inequality, making some people wonder whether we're in a new gilded age. For more now, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
Good. So, what do you think? Are we living in a new gilded age?
I don't know if we need a Great Gatsby sequel quite yet, but the number of people receiving federal food stamps is north of 39 million. That's up 40% from 2008, even as the national population is up just by 8%. You hear all about rents going up and crowding people out. You look at the Bay Area and the homeless crises of Los Angeles and Manhattan. And even above that, a disturbing fraction of Americans still can't come up with, say, $500 for an unforeseen expense.
And we're seeing the number of billionaires in the U.S. more than double in the past decade. Back in 2008, we had 267. Last year, we had 607. How are they making their money?
Sure. Yeah. Tech, entrepreneurship, property values, farmland. You see record art values. The U.S. stock market is again at a record, so portfolios are fat. There's been just a healthy, almost indefatigable mergers and acquisitions market, whether you're talking about small business or family business, public, private. Writ large, I think assets the world over have truly swelled in value in the decade since the financial crisis, and that's just spiked the number of billionaires everywhere.
How much of this is a result of Trump policies, or did the trend predate those?
Look, I think so much of this is driven by tech. You talk about the Gilded Age and big tech. You routinely have the giants of big tech. I mean, even before Trump was in office, they were approaching market values that were bumping up against the trillion, whether you're talking about Amazon or Apple. Jeff Bezos, you take him, the CEO and founder of Amazon. He's worth $121 billion. He spent pocket change that he essentially found in the cushions of his couch to buy the Washington Post. And his company spent, you know, $14 billion to buy Whole Foods. So it's not just big tech, it's big grocery. This is, it's just been an incredible decade for a handful of players. And they've made many, many, many millionaires of employees, and their founders and fellow executives are billionaires as well.
So what is the best hope to try and, I mean, it's never going to have an even playing field, but try and reduce the inequity?
You know, it goes back to the Piketty book and the controversy that it caused, talking about a conversation about wages or a better social safety net. Rich people are going to become wealthy, but are they being taxed at the correct clip for capital gains? If anything, you saw Trump come in and with this record tax plan come in and cut capital gains tax rates for people. It's much easier to keep the upside that you've had. And there are other people like Elizabeth Warren and on the left flank of the Democratic Party saying that some of that has to be recaptured to level the playing field. You talk about even the argument with Medicare for All. If younger people who came of age in the financial crisis professionally are very averse to having to pay full freight for healthcare expenses. So there's at least this conversation, and you're going to see it hit a fever pitch as the kind of the Democratic field whittles down from 25 people to one.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Enjoy a few hot dogs today, Robin.
Likewise, Lisa. Thank you.
Thanks. When David France needs money, he heads underground. He finds his favorite subway stop in Boston and starts playing.
Well, let's say the rent deadline's coming up. It can be hard.
France is a professional violinist, but he was homeless for a time and slept behind the aquarium in downtown Boston. These days, though, he chooses to live frugally. He could be performing and teaching for good money. Instead, he gives his time and talent to help change the lives of teenagers through classical music.
F, don't rush. Q, ready, go.
France teaches, coaches, and cajoles these kids 3 hours a day, 5 afternoons a week, in the cafeteria at the John D. O'Brien School in the Roxbury part of Boston. On this day, 8 high school students pull their seats in a circle, start a metronome, and practice, practice, practice. France calls the group of young musicians the Roxbury Youth Orchestra. It's part of an organization France founded in 2013, Revolution of Hope. Here's the group in concert 2 years ago. David France's life experiences help him identify with some of the kids he teaches. He's the child of immigrants from the West Indies, and he felt a bit adrift when he was young.
I was super shy, and I really needed a voice. And when I was 7, I was offered a chance to play the violin through a free violin program. And so I really kind of found my voice and found my way.
Those free violin lessons changed everything. France developed skills that propelled him to New England Conservatory on a graduate fellowship. He studied the renowned El Sistema program in Venezuela and saw how young people in the neighborhoods, racked by poverty, were uplifted by classical music training. He came to realize students who come from low-income backgrounds can excel just as much as wealthy ones if they have the right teacher.
One, and you cute. Okay. One and two and three and four. And thank you.
Yeah, I don't know you.
Start again. The one person was like, I cued.
No, I was mocking her.
Oh, okay, fine. One and two.
I came with a dream to use music to transform their lives, and they wanted to play these instruments, but they also wanted to have fun.
One, two, cue, and yeah, smile, come on!
France plays equal parts in endearing uncle and sarcastic sibling, but mostly meticulous maestro.
Well, I think he's pretty selfless. Like, he sacrifices a lot of time to be able to teach us all this stuff.
Niaz Uddin is one of 14 kids who played in the orchestra this year. He took up the violin 8 months ago. He and the other students only have to pay $150 a semester. That would normally cover just a few lessons for a kid. The instruments are donated. Niaz says he appreciates that France makes the program affordable and that he doesn't make it easy.
He's very kind, but he's also strict. You could get the wrong idea because he's strict all the time, but behind his strictness, there's meaning in which he wants to teach us more, and he wants us to get better. Maybe ask me to check the mic.
15-year-old Xavier LaPlante says without a program like this, he wouldn't be playing the violin.
Because, like, me and, like, my family, we don't, I'm not going to say, like, we don't have money, but we don't have too much money to, like, spend on these type of things that aren't, like, essential. Like, we can do it, but, like, it wouldn't be too wise.
Before Xavier joined the program, he'd never even been to a concert. His first week with the group, he played in one.
It was invigorating. I kind of forgot the fact that it was my first time there, first time anywhere in this concert and performing in one. I was just, like, submersed in the, like, music. I was enjoying the fact that I was playing the music, playing for other people, that they were enjoying it.
To David France, these kids become musicians the moment they take their instruments in their hands. He sees music and the connections it brings as a vehicle for the students to expand their boundaries.
A lot of times, young people who live in neighborhoods like this, they don't feel other parts of the city are places maybe that they're welcome. Every year when we go to Harvard Square, whether to perform or just to just hang out, there's usually a student who's never been there. And they can get there on the bus or on the train. And so for this music to be a bridge to connecting people who maybe wouldn't normally interact, that's what it means.
One and two and three and bow on the string. Start with the bow on the string, though. One, two, ready, and good. So yeah, can you, like, interact with each other? Because he's like,
There have been times when a student is not very communicative and maybe I see, like, tears rolling down their eyes. And so while I'm tough on their intonation and posture, I might step back a little bit that day and just let them be in their feelings. I think that's probably one of the reasons why they come back, because they're allowed. I don't think young people have many places where they're allowed to be themselves and they're allowed to be moody, to even pack up and walk out without saying anything. And then the next day, not treating them as if they packed up and walked out, you know, giving every new day a new opportunity to allow them to step into hopefully a space where there's a lot of joy.
France wants to help the kids become as musically proficient as possible, whether they plan to pursue careers in music or not. Liana Portillo had studied violin briefly before she joined the orchestra. She says the program has made it her passion.
It's after school. You could be doing a lot of things. Why are you here?
I'm here because I want the violin as my career, so I'm putting in all my work now so that in the future it can pay off later.
And if you didn't have David here, would there be a program for you?
No, because without Mr. Franz, my violin and playing wouldn't even have a meaning behind it.
David Franz says he wants to reach any kids who have a hunger to express themselves through music. One day, a student from a different high school, Nick Allen, wandered into the rehearsal room. Allen likes to rap, and France invited him to freestyle to the orchestra. Now Allen shows up to practice every week.
Mama told me I'ma get it right. I've been working in the kitchen every day and night. Put that food up on my plate, now I'm eating right. Yeah, this my life and now I hustle, so how would you know if you never had a struggle? Against all the odds, rapping like a god.
That last line, I got no limit. Well, that's what David France wants these young musicians to take away from all their practicing and performing.
It's that through learning something as difficult as violin or a cello, that they can get confidence, that they can learn endurance and resilience.
School administrators say that translates into better performance in the classroom for many of the kids. The students have the summer off, most of it anyway. They're performing at an educators' conference in Philadelphia next week. Student Liana Portillo, who wants to play professionally, applied to a summer music academy in Minnesota at David France's urging, and she was accepted. There, she performed her first ever recital last month.
Thank you.
This summer, France plans to indulge his passion for world travel with little luggage but his violin on his back. When he needs a little cash along the way, he'll do some busking. The Netflix series When They See Us looks at the case of the Central Park Five, five teenagers who were arrested and convicted of raping a woman in Central Park in New York in 1989. The men had confessed to the crime after hours of interrogation. The confessions were false, and they were exonerated. Here's some audio of Corey Wise during the interrogation. He was 16 at the time of the assault, the oldest of the boys. The audio is a bit difficult to hear. He says the boys went to the park for trouble and got it.
Mrs. Puff and trouble, got trouble. A lot of trouble. That's what they wanted, and I guess that's what I wanted. If I was doing it, that's what I wanted too. I can't apologize because this is too late. All we gotta do is pay up for what we did.
The teenager's lawyers say the confessions were coerced by police investigators. Those kinds of false confessions are at the heart of an initiative by the Innocence Project. The organization uses DNA testing and reform measures to exonerate those who've been wrongly convicted. The project wants to require that police videotape or audiotape their interrogations. About half the states require taping interrogations, but not Ohio, where a bill has been introduced to remedy that. The bill's Democratic sponsor is Representative Thomas West of Canton, Ohio, speaking to us on Skype. And from New York, Rebecca Brown of the Innocence Project. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for having us.
Representative West, what would your bill do?
It will require law enforcement agencies to record suspect interrogations for most serious crimes, including felonious assault and sexual assault and murder.
So suspect interrogations that can last for any amount of time for, you said, including for murder and sexual assault charge or limited to those charges.
Yes, including those. So some of our most serious crimes, we like to see that videotaped or audiotaped and make it a mandate throughout the state of Ohio. So now some currently there it's being done in some Ohio cities. But we would like to make it standardized all across Ohio.
Is there a particular case that you can point to, Representative West, where you know that an interrogation resulted in someone being wrongly convicted because the session was not recorded?
Well, yes. Now, while there's many cases in Ohio in which interrogation recordings could have helped, a notable case is Dale Johnson. Mr. Johnson was wrongly convicted of a murder. Murdering his stepdaughter and her boyfriend, and they had lack of physical evidence. And when he was in the interrogation, there was problems in the interrogation. But had that been videotaped, had that situation been recorded, then this probably would have been very significant in his outcome, and he could have went free. So that was a big issue, and later he was exonerated.
You have a Republican co-sponsor, Representative Phil Plummer. How much support overall does the bill have, including from police in Ohio?
Well, let me say this. First of all, Phil Plummer, who is a former sheriff of 10 years, come to the legislature with a lot of experience, of course, being in interrogations. And so he's jumped on board. We have the Ohio Chiefs Association on board. And we have the Public Defenders Association on board.
But given that there is apparently a growing lack of trust in law enforcement, especially in the African-American community, will this kind of legislation simply add to that lack of trust?
Well, I think with this legislation, it also will ultimately increase transparency and accountability in our justice system, which then will help in help the matter with respect to people trusting the interrogation process.
Rebecca, do you see this as another tool similar to police wearing body cameras?
Yes, it's quite analogous. And, you know, I often, when we do advocacy around legislation like this, argue that, you know, body-worn cameras are used, you know, with great frequency, you know, all the way through the system. And yet when people are at their most vulnerable in an interrogation room, the tape turns off. And so this is, to us, very much a continuation of that trajectory, that, in fact, it's very important to record interrogation procedures because it gives you a solid record of what transpired in the interrogation room.
And if there is a suspicion that someone was unduly pressured, this could presumably clear the police of that suspicion as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are a lot of benefits to law enforcement for this kind of legislation. You know, it prevents, as you mentioned, false claims of officer misconduct. It allows officers to better prepare for trial. It captures subtle details that might have been lost if the interrogation had not been recorded, which help law enforcement better investigate the crime.
Given that federal law enforcement agents are already required to record interrogations, what evidence do we have that it does make a difference?
We've seen cases where law enforcement unintentionally fed facts about the crime that only the true perpetrator would know during the course of a long interrogation. And so certainly the presence of the videotape or audio tape helps to uncover that. I mean, there are certainly other reforms that are necessary in the area of confessions, but I think that recording of interrogations is the single most important thing we can put into place for starters.
Rebecca Brown of the Innocence Project and Representative Thomas West of Ohio. Nice to speak to you both. Thank you.
It's
a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins. From all of us at Here and Now, have a wonderful 4th.